Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, and today I'm speaking with Nicholas Orme, author of the book Going to Church in Medieval England. Nicholas, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
It's a great pleasure to have you on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm rather elderly now. I've lived in England all my life. I was professor at one of our provincial universities. I retired 15 years ago to Oxford, but I haven't retired from writing, and I still love writing and lecturing.
So what led you to write this book in particular? You have this extensive scholarship in a variety of areas, and what fascinated me when I was reading it was how in this, there's definitely scholarship in this, but it's also in other ways, very much of an introductory overview. And I was wondering what led you to conclude that such a book was needed.
Well, it's a kind of autobiography in a sense. When I graduated from Oxford in 1962, I wanted to do research, and I talked to my supervisor. I actually chose my own topic. I wanted to study medieval English schools. We hadn't been taught anything about the history of education in our degree course, but it struck me that this must be an interesting subject, and it turned out that it was not anything that had been worked on for a very, very long time. Now, if you investigate the history of schools in medieval England, you very soon come across the church, and many of the sources you're going to use are going to be religious history sources. So from that moment at the age of 21, when I was working on medieval schools, I was also learning about medieval church. And I've been with the church the whole of my life. Somebody actually asked me, how do you write a book like this? And I said, well, it's quite simple. You start collecting material when you're 21, and when you get to 80, you write it all up. Anybody can do it. So this is really my distilled experience. All the questions I've wondered about and tried to answer over the whole of my life. And there wasn't a book that covered all these things. There are lots and lots of books on medieval English church history, of course. They tend to be more about the organization, about the relations between popes and kings and how bishops ran their dioceses and so on. But it's the practical that has always interested me. One of the things about schools was actually, how did you organize a classroom? How did you put the pupils onto benches? And then what did you do with them? And I wanted to find that out. And similarly with the church, we have all these wonderful buildings in England of about 10, 11, 12,000 medieval churches. Well, people study the architecture in great detail, but they don't really study how they were used, what actually was going on when you went inside. And so my book is to try and give everybody a very basic guide. How did churches come into existence? Who ran them? How were the buildings used? Who went to church? And what happened when they did?
I was thinking as I was reading it, that couldn't have been easy because as you mentioned, there's so much about the organization of the church in that historians have written about. And yet, as it comes across in your text, that the ordinary experience of church going, the daily life of the church, is not something that is captured as easily in the records and in the literary materials. And yet you have gone back and, you know, discovered to the best of our ability what, you know, that experience was like.
That's right. And the reason why this hasn't been done before is that it's so difficult to get the information. Basically, if people want to know what happened in a medieval church, they go to the prayer books, what we call liturgical books, because they assume that if you've got the book that the priest was using, that's what went on in the church. But actually, if you look at these books, they only contain the material to be spoken. They don't have anything at all about how the church is laid out, where particular bits are done from, what people's reactions are to what's going on. And you can only find that sort of information by looking at, well, it really is many medieval sources as possible, and picking up little bits and then building a mosaic out of these tiny little bits, which is what I've done. But it really needed a whole lifetime's experience of medieval source material of all kinds, architectural and written material. It took a whole life's work of experience to get enough of that stuff. And curiously enough, COVID helped because I'd finished the book and then we were hit by COVID 2 years ago. All the libraries in England closed. I couldn't get into the libraries at all. So I had to use what was available online. And it then became clear that there was an awful lot of stuff available online that I hadn't used, and which was not really very helpful. But as I had absolutely nothing to do except sit in my study every day, I could go through long texts, which I wouldn't normally have bothered with, and get little scraps out. And I could look at a whole book and perhaps I'd get two interesting bits of information from it. And I would never have bothered about that if I hadn't had the kind of solitary confinement that COVID imposed.
I was wondering if you could begin our examination of the book by talking about the parishes that were the foundation of the church in the countryside. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit about how the parishes were established and the role that they played in terms of the church overall and in terms of the lives of the people?
Yes, Christianity came to Britain under the Romans, and it was being established in the 400s, 300s and 400s. But then the Roman Empire collapses and Britain falls into numerous little kingdoms. The Angles and Saxons come and settle in. And such Christianity as there is very disorganized. And many people are pagans. And then in 597, Pope Gregory the Great sends a monk called Augustine to England to start converting the people back to Christianity. Now, the difficulty you have in that situation is how do you actually establish it? There aren't the conditions for building parish churches all over the country, because that takes money, that takes local support, which you haven't necessarily got. The initial support for Christianity in England came from the kings of these little kingdoms that had come into existence after the Romans. And Augustine went to Kent, which is southeast of England, and the king there patronized him and supported him and became a Christian. But the earliest churches they founded were what we call minsters. They were communities of several clergy, because they needed to operate together as a kind of band of missionaries. So from the around about 600 to about 900, you had gradually diffusing over England, you had a number of these minsters, I mean, probably 200 or 300 of them in the end, staffed by little bands of clergy. And it was they who, as it were, laid the foundations then for other churches to come into existence. When you get to about the year 900, England has been Christian now for quite a long time, and people are used to the new religion, and they're also demanding its services. And local chieftains, who we call thanes or lords of manors, decide that they'll have a church on their estate, and that it will consolidate their authority over their tenants and servants if they all go to the same church. So from the 900s, we get the foundation of churches to serve a small area of land. And we still have this parish system in England. Most of the parishes are really very small. They are a couple of square miles, except when you get up into the wilder northern parts where they are bigger. So in the 900s, this is about 100 years, 150 years before the Norman Conquest, you're getting this patchwork of churches spreading all over the country. Each church has a parish, which is to say a territory, which belongs to it. The people in that territory have the duty of going to church and maintaining the church, and in return, the cleric or priest of that church has the duty of providing services and baptisms and marriages and funerals and other pastoral things for all the people who live within the parish.
As you explained, though, it was that the people who were staffing these churches, it was more than just a parish priest. You described that there were a variety of people who served several different functions, and not all of them were necessarily ordained clergy.
Yes, you need a priest for to provide the spiritual services in a church, and he is the person in charge. It's what's called the cure of souls. All the souls in the parish are his responsibility, and he leads the services in church. But of course, you do need other people as well. You need an assistant who is called the parish clerk, because the medieval services in Latin, of course, could not be joined in by the congregation. So you needed somebody to give the responses to what was being said. So you have the parish clerk to do that. And then you've also got to have people to maintain the church. And it became the duty of the lay people in a parish, the parishioners, to maintain most of the church building and also the furniture within the church and the materials, the books and other things that it needed for its services. So you then need people to organise this, and the office of church warden comes into being. You have usually two members of the congregation. they serve in rotation for a year or two, and they collect money to maintain the church, and they spend the money on the church building as well.
How were these people selected? Were the priests chosen from some from the region? Were they brought in from outside the region? And how, and was it the priest that was in charge of selecting these lay parishioners to serve, or were they volunteers who self-nominated?
Well, the appointment of the priest belongs to somebody called the patron, and we still have patrons in the Church of England. What happened, you see, is that when these thanes or lords of manors founded their church in the, let's say, the 900s, it was really down to them to provide the land on which the church was built. Then the priest of the church needed resources for his upkeep. So he was given some fields in the parish to farm. This was known as the glebe. So it followed that having set up the church, the lord of the manor chose the priest. And he was known as the patron. And that has been the case right down the history of the church in England ever since. And the patron could be in the Middle Ages, the period that I've been studying, the patron could be the king, because the king had a lot of lands with churches on them. It could be a member of the nobility. It could be a bishop. It could be a monastery. It could be a local lord of the manor. It didn't go down the social system more than that. So you don't get ordinary people who are patrons of churches. And then with regard to the church wardens, as I said just now, they are chosen by the lay parishioners. But in fact, it goes by rotation. It goes round the farmers of the parish, the more important lay people, or in a town parish, it will be the merchants and shopkeepers. And they do a stint of a year or two in turn, so that everybody gets to have to do it.
One of the things that you provide in your book are a number of illustrations. It's a gorgeously illustrated book. You have lots of colored pictures, and you also have lots of diagrams in your chapter on church buildings, which show the layouts of these churches. And I was especially struck by how you explain the basic layout of the churches and how the layout evolved over the course of the Middle Ages. Could you explain what the layout would have meant to a medieval parishioner, and how the layout of the church contributed to the conducting of Mass, for example?
Yes, an English church is basically divided into two units. Remember, a church is orientated from east to west, because east is the direction of God. You don't have a door on the east side of the church. Somebody asked me this once, why don't you ever have a door on the east side? The answer is that's God's side and he doesn't need a door. So the eastern part of the church is the chancel, and that's where in the Middle Ages the services were done. And then west of that is a larger area, which is known as the nave. The word nave comes from the Latin for a ship, actually. It's like a sort of great upturned ship inside. And that's where the parishioners stand or eventually sit. And between the two, there is a division. Originally, it's a wall with a small archway in it, so that you can see through to some extent. But it makes a statement that what goes on in the chancel, the, the services and the clergy there is different from the nave where the lay people are. And then in the 1100s, they do away with that and they open the church up so that you can see completely through, but they still want to have a division. This is because they regard the services as particularly holy, especially the Mass, the sacrament of the Eucharist or Holy Communion, if you prefer, because that, they believe, is when Christ actually becomes physically present in the bread and wine of the Mass. So you must have a very holy area where Christ may appear. And so to stop people, and indeed dogs, from invading the sacred space, you have this screen, usually a wooden screen with windows in it, so that you get a view, a somewhat restricted view, through of from the nave to the chancel. And one of the interesting questions I pursued was, did they actually manage to keep the two areas separate? And the answer is no, because you immediately get the problem that the Lord of the Manor wants to be in the chancel. I mean, it's his church. He's not going to be in the nave. And then other important people want to have seats up there as well. And then there are occasions when you've got to have people up there anyway, on Easter Sunday when they receive communion, on other occasions when they make offerings and they put them on the altar of the church, which is up at the east end, and so on. And one of the interesting things in my book is this tug of war that goes on with the church insisting that this is a sacred area and the lay people constantly encroaching on this area. But as well as the chancel and the nave in a church, you can have lots of other areas. It doesn't mean to say that all churches do, and there are some very small ones which only have the two parts. But you can enlarge a church by putting aisles, that is, long corridors alongside the chancel and nave. You can put chapels, which are a sort of smaller accretions. You can put one, a lady chapel, beyond the east end of the chancel. You can have transepts, which are arms sticking out, and other things. And of course, you want a tower for your church as well, because bells are important in signalling when there are services, and they are used during services as well. So you've got to stick a tower on somewhere, usually at the West End, but sometimes in other places, or sometimes completely separate from the church.
One of my favorite chapters was your chapter on the congregations themselves. And I got the impression that was, you know, a chapter that would have been, you know, difficult to assemble, given how the focus is always on the priest and the church and not necessarily on the parishioners. But I was really it was a really interesting read to discover how they might have viewed the church, how they might have viewed the faith, how the faith existed for them, and the role of the church in their lives. And I was wondering if you could perhaps explain what how they interacted with the parish church and the role that it played in their daily lives.
Yes, in the early period of Christianity in England, in the early Anglo-Saxon times, from 597, when Christianity came back, the first few centuries, going to church was very much a voluntary activity. But as the church got more and more entrenched, the voluntary attendance turned into a compulsory attendance. And this is certainly the case by about the 1100s, certainly the 1200s. Church has by that stage become very strong and influential. So from the age of puberty, you have to go to church on Sundays and festival days. Now, it's all very well having a law, isn't it? But people don't obey it. We have all sorts of laws about traffic or public behavior or theft or whatever, but people don't obey them. And so one of the interesting things to trace in the Middle Ages is how far people actually obeyed the rule and did go to church. And the answer is that a great many people didn't. The church itself had to make exceptions. There were some people who couldn't get to church, like shepherds on hills looking after their sheep, you know. They just couldn't be got down there. You've got sailors, fishermen. If the shoal of herring comes in, the fishermen are all going to go out after it. And we need them to go out after it to get food. So they get accepted. You get exceptions for people travelling, for merchants, servants, of course, because the wealthy, when they've been to church, want to go back home for dinner. So the servants are back home getting the dinner. And so they can't be there, or perhaps they go in the afternoon, but they can't be there in the morning. And then there are an enormous number of people who would much rather do something with their Sunday, because Sunday was the holiday of the week. People worked the other 6 days. Peasant farmers had their holdings to look after, you know, they had their animals, there were jobs they would have liked to have done, or they would have just liked to be at home with their feet up rather than in church. So there was always a struggle to get people to go to church. And if the church really insisted, it could make people go. But the process of making them go was just as difficult as it is nowadays for us to make people toe the line. So the people who tended to get into trouble, I think, were those who were unpopular in the community. So if you've upset too many people and don't go to church, you will be in trouble because the community will report you. And the priest will report you, and the priest will have the backing of the community. If you're a popular person in the community, it's much more difficult for the priest to take action against you, because he will alienate your friends, and this will just cause more trouble for him in the end. So it must have been a lot of give and take in these matters. And I suspect that perhaps 80% of those who should have been there were there, or at least were there for part of the service, and perhaps a 20% were actually doing something else. And of course, it would always be easy to say on Monday, well, I'm terribly sorry to the priest, but I had a cold yesterday.
I was also thinking about the tension that you write about in that chapter between when the people who did attend and their behavior in the church, and how there's this certain expectation that you describe in terms of their behavior that was not necessarily followed through in practice. People would bring their dogs in. People would not patiently stand there as they were expected to. They would bring stools to sit, and of course, during various times they would bring in food even, and it made the notion of a parish service seem a lot more lively and unruly than one might imagine for the times.
The trouble you get into with church history is that you're trying to simplify what was going on in 10, 11, 12,000 places. So there's plenty of evidence of these kind of misdemeanors that you're talking about, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they happened in every church every week. the food issue was very much that of Easter Sunday, actually, because people had been fasting from a lot of food during Lent, and they were desperate on Easter Sunday when the fast ended to get into their food, and they brought it to church. But on the whole, I think the services were listened to with a reasonable degree of reverence. But of course, again, you've got to, if you want the whole of your population to go to church, you're going to get everybody, irrespective of whether they approve of being there or are capable of being there. I mean, in modern churches in the USA and England, those who go to church want to go to church, I guess. Possibly some children, not quite so much. But if you are making everybody go to church, then you've got the resistant people going unwillingly, who are going to talk or whatever. You've got quarrels between people which are brought to church. People shouting at other people. You've got people with mental health problems going to church who may be unable to cope with the atmosphere or do the same as other people do. So that's why you've got a lot more wildness, or potentially wildness and disturbances in churches, than you would expect to find in a church nowadays.
One of the things that you highlight in your book is the rhythm of church life, how it was that the church had was active daily, but it also functioned. There were patterns over the course of a week. There were patterns over the course of the seasons, patterns over the course of the year. I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us a little bit about a week in the life of a parish church generally, sort of what were the key periods of service, what happened in the parish church between the various services that took place?
Yes, well, the whole basis of Christian worship is that it is a good thing to worship God, that in heaven there is continuous praise and worship of God by the angels and the saints and those who have passed from this life to heaven, and that on earth Christians should do the same. Now, because most people have far too much in their lives to do more than occasional private prayer, you needed people to pray on behalf of society, and that was what the clergy did. So you've got monks in monasteries and nuns in nunneries, friars in friaries doing it. And in each parish, you've got the priest of the parish church doing it. In principle, the worship of God was to go on for the whole of the day. And they had services to mark midnight, dawn, and evening. They also had services to mark the one of the most important days in Christian history, that is Good Friday, the crucifixion of Christ. So you also had services at 9 a.m., 12 noon, and 3 p.m., or 1500 hours, the key moments of the crucifixion. So you had eight services altogether. Now, in a monastery where the clergy have nothing else to do but worship God, it was possible to do that, but it wasn't possible in a parish setting, because a parish priest had other things to do in his life. He had his farm, which he had to supervise. He obviously wouldn't do all the farming himself. He would have a servant or two to do that for him. But he had to look after his own affairs. He had to deal with his parishioners. He had to hear confessions, for example. So in the parish setting, what they did was to join the services together in bunches. And there were three bunches. There was a bunch of services at dawn or soon afterwards, which they called matins. There was a bunch in the middle of the morning, round about 8 or 9 a.m., usually including a mass or communion and some other little services. And finally, there were services in the middle of the afternoon, about 3 o'clock, which they called evensong. So you've got those three services, effectively, in a church. They have to happen every day. But of course, you can't expect people to attend them every day because lay people have all their duties and responsibilities in life. So they must attend on Sunday, or they must certainly attend Mass on Sunday, and they're urged to attend matins and evensong on Sunday as well, but it's much less likely that they all did. During the week, they could go in if they wanted to. It was probably the case that this was more common in towns than in the countryside, because I think in the countryside everybody was at work, not only men but women. I mean, women had household tasks to do, and indeed were often involved in primary production of food and services as well. In towns where you've got more leisured people, it is feasible that they will go to church during the week. Merchants particularly may have time off from the office, from their work. They can depute it to somebody else. They can go out and attend Mass in the morning. And towns also had an early Mass at dawn called the Morrow Mass, which would be possible to attend before you actually started your work. The merchants' wives are not so busy as country housewives are. They've got servants. And it's a recreation for them to leave the house because going to church is an acceptable way for leaving home. And they can meet their friends at Mass. So you will, in a town, you will get people at services during the week, but not to any great extent in the countryside, I think.
So what was the pattern of church-like life over the course of a year? Were there periods where church attendance was more intensive due to the liturgical calendar, or was it staggered in such a way so that there were always a regularity to when people would be attending for various spiritual religious purposes?
Yes, there's a very complicated calendar of religious worship during the year. And it starts on Advent Sunday, which is 4 weeks before Christmas. And it divides into two halves, from Advent Sunday up to Whitsuntide or Pentecost, which is sometime in June, usually. The church is following the life of Christ. So with Advent, we're looking forward to the coming of Christ. And then we have Christmas, the birth of Christ. We have Lent, the fasting of Christ. We have Holy Week, when Christ was tried and crucified. And then you have the Easter period of his resurrection and so on. So that's what dominates the church services, the readings and the prayers. And then from the lesser second half of the year, which is nowadays called ordinary time. You don't have that particular journey, but you have other things that that the services are about. You've then got saints' days, of which they had a great number. I think it was about 250. Some of these are holidays, not by any means all of them, but about 30 or 40 are holidays, so people will be expected not to work on those. The other saints' days will only really be observed by the clergy in churches in the prayers that they use. And the church year goes through periods that you can call penitential periods, and periods that are festival periods. So the Christian life is partly one of repentance and it's partly one of celebration. So Advent was a penitential season. You were getting ready for Christmas. You were urged to fast from meat, certainly, and if you were very devout, from eggs and butter and cheese. Then you get to Christmas, and that's of course a time of great festivity, and they kept you know, famously the 12 days of Christmas as a holiday time, although I think peasant farmers and their families would have still had to do an awful lot of work then anyway. Then you get to Lent, which is another period of fasting, and again you are not allowed to eat any meat or dairy products. So the only protein you eat is fish. And that goes up to Easter Day, and then you get another period of festivity from Easter for the next 6 weeks. Then you have another small period of austerity, which is Rogation Week, when they went round the parish praying for the success of the crops. That was a period of fasting as well, but it wasn't such a severe fast. Dairy foods were allowed in Rogation Week. And then when you finish that, for the rest of the year, you can eat what you want, and we're not being particularly penitential or particularly festal either. So you have this very interesting cycle, which is the same every year, and then the saints' days, which are holidays, are peppering this, and they're coming up from time to time as well, and they have their own observances, such as Candlemas, which we've just gone past. The 2nd of February is when you take a candle to church, and we celebrate the giving thanks to the Virgin Mary after the birth of Christ, and everybody has to hand over their candle to the priest.
Now, you mentioned that not everyone necessarily attended church in the parish, but there you also describe how there are periods in a person's life where the church played, in which the people's lives interacted with the church. And I'm talking about those six periods that you describe in your book where the church played a major role in terms of bringing a person into the church, standing at various transition and playing a role at various transition points in their lives. I was wondering if you could explain how in the Middle Ages in England the church, you know, played this role, and what people expected from the church and what the church required of them.
Yes, in addition to the formal worship that goes on in church, the church is providing pastoral services for individual people. And the first of these is baptism, because it is already believed by the time that Augustine comes to England in 597 that if you're going to achieve salvation, you have to be baptized. In the early church, they baptized adults, but as the church became established, it became natural for parents to want to have their babies baptized as well, to give them the benefit of salvation from the very moment of their life. And that became established in England, certainly by the time of the Norman Conquest, that every child is taken to church to be baptized, either on the day of birth or very, very soon afterwards. You would have been frowned on not only by the clergy, but by your family if you had delayed doing that. So on the day of birth, the mother has given birth. She doesn't go to church. The midwife takes the baby to church along with the parents. The godparents, you have to have three godparents, two of the baby's gender and one of the opposite gender. And they are going to be additional spiritual protectors of the baby during its life. They have a responsibility specifically to look after its religious training, but also its life generally. And I think if parents died, the godparents would become responsible. So the baby is taken, and the service of baptism is interesting because the baby can't go straight into church. See, it's not Christian. So you have to Christianize it outside the door. And that's why porches, very elaborate porches, were built on churches so that the first part of the baptism service could be done outside. And you say various prayers, or the priest does rather, and he exorcises the child. And make sure that there's no demon or satanic influence inside it. And then when that's been done, the baby can be brought into church and it's taken to the font, which is a stone basin on a pillar, which is at the west end of the church by the main entrance. And these fonts, which you still see in churches in this country, and I guess in the USA as well, were originally big enough to allow a baby to be totally immersed in the water. So the font is full of water, and the baby is, with accompaniment of prayers, is immersed in the water totally three times, and then taken out, wrapped in a cloth, and given to the senior godparent. And then you have refreshments in church after that. The next in the series is that the mother, after 40 days, goes to church for what was known as her purification, although the popular word for it was churching. The Jewish religion had the idea that women were made impure by giving birth. The Christian church didn't quite have that idea, but as the Virgin Mary had been purified or churched after the birth of Christ, they decided it was a good idea. They didn't keep women out of church before the 40 days, but on the 40th day, it was appropriate for the woman to go with women in support to attend Mass, to offer the cloth which the baby had been wrapped in, which had become holy, so that had to be returned to the church. And she didn't receive communion, but she was there, and that was a milestone in her life and her recovery. The one that is not that they did not follow was any kind of right for attaining adulthood. So they thought the puberty, round about 12 for girls and 14 for boys, was a very major change in life, because it gave you not only sexual maturity, but they thought intellectual maturity. They believed that it was only with puberty that you really attained full understanding. So it's rather surprising that they didn't have any right for puberty, for making people adult members of the church. What seems to have happened was that round about puberty, sometimes a little bit earlier, but certainly not much later, you went along with the adults to do what they did in Lent and Easter. Now, in Lent, you had to go to confession. Everybody had to go to confession at least once a year to their parish priest during Lent. And then on Easter Day, they received communion, and that was the only day on which most people ever did receive communion. So the 12 and 13-year-olds went along to that, and that was what made them adults. But they weren't marked out in any particular way. They simply went along with the adults and then joined in what they did. And then after that, they were counted as adults. I've forgotten to mention confirmation. Now, that's something that in many churches nowadays is linked with an age round about puberty or growing up. But in the medieval church, it could be done at any time in your life at all. It was simply the church authorities, the bishop, rubber stamping your baptism. If you were really important, when your baby was born, you had a bishop on hand. And after the baptism, the bishop would confirm. But confirmation didn't confer any privileges at all. It didn't, after about 1200, it didn't entitle you to receive communion, for example, which you could only do when you reached puberty. So you've got to slot in confirmation at some point along with that. Then you've got marriage. Marriage can be at any date from puberty onwards, but typically it's later. Among the property classes, it's often in the teens, but for the vast majority of the population, it's in the mid-20s, with men usually marrying a couple of years later than women. And that's simply because if you're going to get married, you've got to have a home and an occupation. So if you're a servant in a house, how can you possibly marry? Your employer doesn't want a wife living in. It's only after a certain period of time when you've saved money, perhaps, or your parents have retired or died, and you can take over their work or their peasant holding, that you can afford to get married. The church had a rather equivocal attitude to marriage. Marriage didn't really fit in. You see, with all the main church sacraments, pastoral actions, it's the church that gives the gift. In other words, it's the priest who baptizes, it's the bishop who confirms. But in a marriage, it's the two partners who do the essential thing, which is to promise to marry each other. And although the church said you should be married in church, they never actually insisted on this. And this was not the case in England right down to the middle of the 18th century. It's very, very late that church marriage became compulsory in England, and it then ceased to be compulsory around about 1837 when registration of marriages was introduced as well. So it was always possible to go off and get married as long as you said to each other, "I marry you." That did it as far as the church was concerned. Of course, you need to have witnesses because there's the danger that after a few years, you know, one party will say, "Oh, I never did." So you need to have some, preferably to have witnesses there. But as long as those vows have been exchanged, that is, in the eyes of the church, a valid marriage. And then we finally get on to sickness and death. So if you are ill, the priest will come. If you're dangerously ill, at any rate, the priest will come and he will give you the rite of anointing or unction. He will bring holy oil with him, and he will apply that to parts of your body to give you spiritual healing, which it is hoped will lead to physical healing. But if it doesn't, at least will make you spiritually pure. And he'll hear your confession. If you're really at death's door, he will give you communion as well. And then should you die, there will be a funeral service. This will take place fairly soon after death, probably the next day. The body will be taken by your family and friends to the church. It will lie in the church overnight. Prayers may be said, or a watch may be kept by your family and friends. And then on the following morning, there will be a funeral mass, a requiem mass, as it's called, at which special prayers for the dead are made. And then everybody will go to the grave in the, usually for most people, in the churchyard. Only very important people are buried in the church itself. The church will have been dug and by the sexton, who's one of the minor church officials. And then the body, usually not in a coffin, but in a shroud or wrapping, will be placed in the grave. The grave will be filled up with prayers being said, and that is the last rites, and that's the last of the ways in which the church ministers to you and to your soul.
Now, what you've described is, and as you made clear, it's you've summarized the experience of the church in the Middle Ages, and it's commonly understood that a lot of this changes with the Reformation in the 16th century. And yet, as you explain at the beginning of your chapter on that, many of the changes that took place during the Reformation are foreshadowed or begin prior to the 1520s. I was wondering if you could explain how the practice of going to church changed during the Reformation and the ways in which it was changing prior to the Reformation.
I think the Reformation still casts a shadow over us, doesn't it? If we are Protestants, we believe it was an important and an essential stage in church history. And if we're Catholic, we regard it as something rather regrettable that divided what had previously been an undivided church. So that narratives of the Reformation tend, whether the people are Protestant or Catholic or agnostic, do tend to major on change as happening. I'm rather doubtful about this because, as you say, I can see the Reformation coming well before it does. It is, to some extent, an adjustment to changes that have been going on. And the church has always adjusted itself as ideas and society has changed over the centuries. So it's one of those adjustments. And while I don't at all wish to rule out the very large changes that were made, I mean, in England, the authority of the Pope is brought to an end. The papal laws are ended. The services are translated from Latin into English. Clergy are allowed to marry. Monasteries are all closed down. Those are all very, very major changes. But and also one should say that the interiors of parish churches are changed, because the reformers in England dislike what they call superstition. So they remove altars and images and paintings of saints and all the ceremonial that there had been in the medieval church. The services become much plainer and simpler. Indeed, I characterize the typical Reformation church as the church as a schoolroom, with all obedient pupils sitting on benches, with the schoolmaster priest instructing them in prayer and in sermons up at the far end of the church. But I wanted to emphasize continuity, because I think that so much of the work that's been done on the Reformation doesn't quite do justice to it. And so much remained very much the same. And it occurs to me that the sensible English reformers didn't try to do too much to upset what ordinary people were used to. So baptisms continue to be compulsory, churching of women, confirmation now becomes something that's to be done to older children, marriages in church, funerals in church, they all continue. And although if you read the English prayer books of the Reformation period, the services are much simpler, the prayer books don't tell you anything about what else was going on. I mean, you've only got to go to a wedding, haven't you, and see the immense amount of effort that's put into making the church nice in terms of flowers and that sort of thing, and the dresses of the bride and groom, and the reception you're going to have afterwards. Well, the Reformation didn't change any of that. You could still do all those sorts of things. It also kept the requirement of going to church on Sundays, but it didn't increase the amount of time. In fact, the amount of time you spent in church was probably much the same. And very importantly, it kept the seating. Now, this is something that we haven't previously discussed, but seating came into English churches in the 1300s, it seems. And it started with the important people who wanted comfort, and it gradually spread down because everybody wanted comfort, and it was much more comfortable having seats than standing. And although you were expected to kneel during parts of the service, it's much easier to kneel in a seat. It's easier to get down and up by holding on to the seat around you. And seating was allocated according to social status. So the important people are in the chancel, the less important people are up at the front of the nave, the less important people, servants, the poor, are at the back of the nave. And people like this because it confirms the social relationships that they have outside church. When they go into church, they're not being expected to all be equal. Although Christianity regards us all as equal, some are more equal than others, in George Orwell's famous phrase. And the great thing about seating is you've got your own seat, your own bit of space. Nobody else can be in it because they didn't just go in as you might do nowadays and sit on a seat. You had your designated seat. You sat there. Nobody else did. All that was kept. And much else was kept as well. The church wardens, the ways in which churches were financed, the duties that people had. Of course, the moral laws remained exactly the same as they had been in the past. So the Reformation is always a very difficult event to summarize, but what I wanted to do was to say alongside the changes, there were many, many things that remained exactly the same. And if somebody had happened to be out of the country for 40 years between 1530 and 1570 and had come back, they would have seen an awful lot of things that they were used to.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Believe it or not, at the moment I'm writing ghost stories.
Well, that sounds very interesting. I look forward to reading them when you're done.
Thank you very much.
Nicholas Orme, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
I've enjoyed it very much indeed, Mark, and I'm most grateful for your invitation.